Grateful believer, recovered and recovering alcoholic. And my sobriety is January 3rd, 2002. My home group is the Golden Text Group of Hollywood, Florida.
Woo!
I'm very, very honored to be here with you guys. You know, usually this is the time I come up with something very funny to say about my hosts or about the convention. But tonight, it just feels different. It feels very, very sacred. This room feels very sacred. I know we're going to have a good time. It's going to be a fun talk. I'm sure the Lord's definitely going to show up. But just being around the sobriety, being around you people, I felt like really blessed tonight. My hosts, Sean and Brandy, and everyone that greeted me here was just so loving to my wife and I. I mean, the people in Louisiana are very nice. I don't know if you've known that. You can give yourselves a round of applause. Sometimes when you're from a place, you don't realize how nice you are, but we'll invite you to Florida and see if you'll realize how nice you are. I'm from New York, and my beautiful wife is from the country of Colombia. She's the Al-Anon speaker tomorrow, and basically, I gave her a talk, so if you want to show up tomorrow, it's my... Really, I did it, so... Alcoholics Anonymous changed our life. Not only changed our lives, it gave us a life. I've been in AA since I'm 21 years old, but my sobriety is around 22 years. I just like say something during the countdown. I don't know if this has ever happened to you. I kind of wanted the lie. You know, I wanted more year. And I realized right then I wasn't spiritually fit because I was kind of upset that they jumped, like, because usually I could sneak a couple years. I'm not saying I lie, but usually I could sneak a couple years depending on, you know, if I pretended I heard the 22 or the 23. And these people, they just jump 5 years at a time. They just skip right by you. And I wanted to kind of like stay up there long. Where I'm from in Long Island, New York. Anybody here from New York? One person. Okay, that's awesome. I realized when I saw the name of the Deep South Convention, it might have just been me and you. I thought that the entire world centered around New York. And I felt like the entire New York centered around me. And yet you'd think a person that felt like the whole world centered around him and the whole world centered around New York, that he would feel comfortable in his own skin, and I never felt comfortable in my own skin. I always felt like I was the only person in the family that didn't get the instructions. I felt like when I went to the playground and everyone was pushing the spinning thing, the merry-go-round in that direction, and I had to go and push it in the other direction, that everyone felt the same way, that everyone felt uncomfortable in their own skin. But then when I looked around, it didn't seem like they felt uncomfortable in their own skin. Recently, while I was doing a step series in Florida, my mom was there. My mom comes to all my talks, which is such a blessing. And my dad did too, may God rest his soul. He went home to be with the Lord with 27 years. He came in when he was 60. He went home to be with the Lord when he was 88. That's a pretty good run there in Alcoholics Anonymous. She reminded me, oh no, she told me, when I was telling her that I had a pretty normal childhood, and she told me after, you remember something, she said, you didn't have a normal childhood. You got kicked out of Mrs. McGillicuddy's nursery school. Like, I failed nursery school because I was a biter. I bit the other kids, and nobody got kicked out of Mrs. McGill. She was the nicest person. She said, Marie, to my mom, she said, Marie, Stephen can't come back. My mom said, why, what's going on? He bites the other children. And it hadn't gotten better ever since. Basically, I've been biting some people for a long time. I felt in my neighborhood's separated by blocks. In the Northeast, everything's by blocks. It's your neighborhood, it's your block. Those are the people that you knew. Those are the people you hang with. And it just so happens, in my block, all the kids on that street, they have big brothers. I don't know if you come from big brothers, if you had big brothers. If you have big brothers, you're blessed because you have like your own team. You have your own backup system. And in my neighborhood, there was the Mundingers and the Wagmans and the Cohens and the Modders. They all had three brothers. Everybody in my neighborhood had three brothers. So when they would walk over to the playground, they would get a lot of juice with three brothers because that's your pod, that's your squad. And I had a little chubby sister. You get no juice with a chubby sister. You walk to the playground, she's holding your hand, and you have no backup system. And I felt like if I had a backup system, if someone would have taught me sports, if I would have had my own gang, if I would have had my own stuff, then I wouldn't have felt so insecure. So early on, I started to put labels on things to try to figure out why I didn't feel good about myself. And the first label I put on myself was because I didn't have big brothers. Yeah, of course you know how to play baseball. You have big brothers. Of course you beat everybody up because you know how to do that. You know, of course you did that. And everything was about to change for me with that. I'll tell you a little story so you can get a little picture on my childhood. I like to lie. Any people in here were liars before you drank? I was an amazing liar. See, there's people in here that drank and became alcoholics. And I appreciate you and I respect you. You drank enough to become an alcoholic. I was an alcoholic before I ever had a first drink. I was absolutely bona fide alcoholic. As a matter of fact, I was so alcoholic that when I took my first drink, that was the magical solution for my alcoholism. One drink made me feel just right. I felt fine. I didn't have alcoholism because I drank. I drank because I had alcohol. When I was in the 7th or 8th grade, I don't remember. I came from a big school, you know, 2,500 kids. But a lot of us know each other like you do in school. But there was a new coach that came to town and was employed at our school. And as he was going through the roster, he got to my last name, Boyarsky. And he said, "Boyarsky." And I go, "Yes, coach." And he said, "Does your brother play for the Pittsburgh Panthers?" Now, right at that moment, you know, there's 500 kids watching me. We've been coming up for a long time together. Right at that moment, that the easy answer when you don't have a brother is to say no. But right then, I knew everything was about to change for me. And I said, "Yes, he does, coach. Yes, he does." Now, all the kids in the school, they looked over at me and they knew I didn't. First of all, they knew I didn't have a brother, so that was not really good. Second of all, I did have a stepbrother that was a plumber from Massachusetts. And I just didn't want to tell you guys about it. And at that moment, when I made that statement that Jerry Boyarsky, that played for the Pittsburgh Panthers, was my brother, at that moment, I don't know if this ever happened to you, that became truth to me. I had newspaper, I had jerseys. When he got drafted into the NFL, it was a banner day in my life. I mean, people were like, "I can't believe your brother got drafted into the NFL." I'm like, "It's an incredible blessing." That's the story of my life. I would tell a lie so many times that I would fool myself until it was true, until it was become grayed out in my matters in my brain. And then when someone said, "That's not true," I would absolutely be able to pass a lie detector test because I had told it so many times. You know, the big book tells us that even people that don't seem like they're going to be able to get sober will get sober as long as they're able to be honest. Sometimes that's one of the hardest things for recovering people, to be honest.
Yes.
Because we've been lying for so long, we don't really know what honesty is. And that's why the steps are designed, if you're new here, the steps are designed not to do alone. I like to do the fifth step alone. I think that it would be just between me and God. But when it got to the fifth step, it turned out there was things that I needed some outside counsel on with a sponsor so that when I shared those things and then my sponsor would give me feedback. It turns out this entire program, which is incredibly sacred in every way, written by a big book that to me is an ordained literature by the Lord himself, first 164 pages anyway, is that this is something that God designed, not only that we won't feel alone anymore, but that this dishonesty and this dis-ease and all the disses that we have inside us, if we really accurately put effort into working this program, that our lives will actually change. And if you're new, raise your hand. First of all, if this is your first conference convention, raise your hand if this is your first convention. My brother here. Yeah, yeah. I want you to know that there's conferences and conventions going on all the time. If you're a young person, they are young people's conventions. which are really wild. If you're an older person, you can still go to the younger person convention. They call Icky Paws and Wicky Paws and Sticky Paws and Sticky Buns. It's an amazing time in Alcoholics Anonymous, and conventions are fun, and you should come and have a great sober weekend. And I know many people have done that over years. We have, we've traveled the country, really traveled the world going to conventions and conferences. I think it's one of the great perks, one of the great blessings of us doing this together. This is not a self-help program. So welcome to all the newcomers here in that. And then can I get a show of hands on anybody that's under a year sobriety? Can we give these people the round of applause? There's going to be probably tomorrow night, there's going to be a countdown for the newest person, I would imagine. And I want you to know something. Stick around. Because the way that that person got to be the oldest person is one day he was the newest person.
Yeah, that's right.
And one night after I relapsed, I'm going to tell you that story. One night after I relapsed, because I thought that I could drink again. It all started here in New Orleans. As a matter of fact, I'm going to tell you that story. About a year and a half later, we went to a dinner in Florida, and I was the newest person. Mm-hmm. I had just drank that day, and it was a gratitude dinner. And I didn't want to be there. I was just going there because my wife dragged me there. They did the countdown, and of course, I was the newest person. I had drank that day. And I got the big book that the person's probably going to get tomorrow night, which is such a blessing. And now I'm not the newest person. Now I got almost coming up on 23 years, one day at a time. So if you're new here, I want you to know something. You're in for an amazing ride. It's not just going to be sobriety. You're going to get sober. You're not going to drink again. That's one of the benefits of a relationship with God. But you're going to have a life beyond your wildest dreams.
Yep.
We have recovered. We will know peace.
Yes.
The promises and the nice stuff. These things are happening. And there's people that you're going to meet that are just hanging in there and they're just sober. You just move along. You don't want that. There's people like this fine couple that I just met here and the gentleman on there. And all the people that, a lot of people I've met here that are doing a lot more than sobriety. They're doing life beyond their wildest dreams. I never wanted to be me. And the coolest kid in my neighborhood, his name is Kevin. He was big. And I was never going to be the smartest, so I didn't go that route. I was never going to be the best athlete, so I didn't go that route. So I wanted to be the toughest. That didn't really work out either. But at least I chose a path. And Kevin was the toughest kid. He had already gotten left back. He was already big in my class. Then he got left back, and he was like the biggest. And I didn't think Kevin would ever want to hang out with me, so I bribed him, and I said, I went to his house, and I said, do you want to hang out with me? Back, 40 years ago, we could say, would you like to come out and play with me? But I think you can't say that now. So I'm giving you like the new talk. And I said, would you like to come out and hang out with me? And then he said, why would I want to hang out with you? And I said, because I have guns. And in my neighborhood in New York, that was not common. But my dad, may God rest his soul, was a Korean War hero. He had fought on Pork Chop Hill, and we had guns. So I invited Kevin over to blow stuff up, because that's what we like to do. And Kevin was about to leave. And when he was about to leave, all my insecurities came over, because I didn't want the kids in the school tomorrow to know that Kevin and I didn't spend a lot of time. I wanted to get back, that I was cool enough to hang out with Kevin. I don't know if you have that in you. I don't know if you have low self-esteem. I don't know if you had low self-esteem. I don't know if you have that low self-esteem. But I certainly embody that. And I can embody that now. I can embody that now if I'm not spiritual. And Kevin was about to leave, and I said, Kevin, don't leave. You can shoot at me. It seemed like a great idea at the moment. Some of you can see how that ended right there. Now, I don't know if this happens to you, but it's happened to me a lot in my life. I forego the consequences of tomorrow to try to get the benefits of the pleasure in the moment. That has not worked out a lot in my life. And I said to Kevin, wait, don't leave. You can shoot at me. And he shot at me and blew out my right eye. And my whole life changed. And as I was laying there on the lawn, and my beautiful little sister, 3 years younger than me, was trying to minister to me, trying to hold the rag over my eye, and I was bleeding all over the place. I was so codependent on what other people thought about me that the only thing I was thinking about with my eye blown out of my head is, I can't tell anybody in school that Kevin did it, so I have to make a story up that I did it so that he would still like me. And I know that seems funny on the surface, but those feelings are to my core. I'm so concerned about, if I'm not spiritually fit, I'm so concerned about what you think of me that I'm willing to forego anything I think of me. I'm so concerned about how it looks that I'm willing to do anything to appear that I'm okay. And that's how I got into all drugs and drinking. And I'm not going to talk about drugs here, don't worry. So much sobriety here, so much. I'm not going to get into drugs, so everybody just calm yourself down. I see some of the old times, they're like, that's good, son, that's good. But I mean, but if in my story I say that I was rolled up in a carpet for 3 days, that's not scotch. Okay, I just need you to fill in the blank. I'm not going to say what happened, but I mean, that's just silly, okay? If I say I was peeping out of a window for 4 days thinking the police were about to come to my house, that's not bourbon. Okay, so I need you to fill in stuff. Okay, that's all. Okay, everybody relax. This whole section here, you just relax. But I'm a real alcoholic. I'm just not a pure alcoholic. I got involved in some stuff. Anybody in here got some stuff? Everybody got some stuff? Well, I got to tell you, there's a guy in the big book who got involved in some stuff, too, called, in the third edition. He's called Dr. Alcoholic Addict. He got into some stuff. And we get into some stuff, don't we? We get into some stuff because after we take a first drink and we have all full plans of not doing anything other than a drink, after we take that first drink and somebody comes up to us, you know, and says, hey, listen, we just made some stuff from Home Depot. It's in the bathtub in the back. We're like, okay, that sounds fine. But after you take your first drink, everything comes down. Inhibitions go down. You get a little, you sleep with people you didn't even recognize the day after. Things happen. You break out in spots. County jail, Chicago. Things happen. And things started to happen for me pretty fast. And I got involved with some pretty expensive dry goods. It was the 80s. And just do the math. Just do the math. Okay? And it got bad, fast. And where I'm from in New York, it was a plague. It was an epidemic. I don't know if that's the way it was here, but it was an epidemic where I was from. And I became from a casual user to an addict. Now understand something. My primary disease is alcoholism. The reason I went to alcohol was alcoholism. The reason I went to drugs was alcoholism. When I take all that away, the alcoholic is still around. It has nothing to do with what I'm using. If I don't work the steps, if I don't have a relationship with God, if I didn't turn my will and my life over to the care of my Creator today, alcoholism returns, sober or not. It has nothing to do with the substance. When everybody gets upset with the substance, well, you can't say that kind of stuff. Well, that's what happened. This is my story. You can't make up a story. And it got real bad real fast. I didn't have the money for the drug that I wanted, so it couldn't get real bad. And then my uncle, who was a very famous medical doctor in Florida, he died on the bottom of a swimming pool drinking Dom Perignon with the waiters at the local restaurant. He had a house on the Intercoastal. He was a millionaire. He was 42. He was a genius. He had taught himself how to speak Italian while he was in medical school in Italy. I flunked out of English in America. Do you understand the difference? You understand how big of a deal that is? My uncle had alcoholism. Alcoholism doesn't care how smart you are. Matter of fact, the smarter you are, sometimes the harder it is to get sober. He died on the bottom of a swimming pool in Fort Lauderdale. Where I'm from, where I wound up living. And I inherited a lot of money. And I was in my senior year of college, and then of course money and a substance abuse problem, the two went together, and things got bad, real fast. And then I went from being a casual user to a person that was a strung out addict. And my parents sent me to a treatment center. And I know that probably sounds very casual today, but you know, 35 years ago, not everybody was going to treatment. It wasn't like the fourth option, you know, college, work, army, and treatment. It was different. And I went to treatment, 21 years old. Nobody in my neighborhood ever went to treatment. Nobody's never told me 12 steps. We knew one guy in AA named Mr. Woolley. He lived in the court. Nobody we knew was in the program. Like, we didn't grow up in the program. I didn't know about the program. I didn't know about like everything I said, I didn't know about it. But I knew I had a drug problem, and I failed out of school. I took a medical leave of absence. Not really failed, but like a medical leave of absence. I had a lot of migraines. And they sent me to a young people's treatment program in the middle of the country, Minnesota. And I was not prepared. I was totally not prepared. I don't know if anybody went to treatment in here. Now people know about treatment, and probably some of you guys have been to treatment, right? Well, I was not prepared. My mom had put in a VHS tape of 28 days with Michael Keaton. 28 days? Or clean and sober? Clean and sober. I'm sorry. 28 days with Sandra Bullock. That was the after I relapsed, she gave me the DVD of that one. But the first one was a VHS tape, and that was Michael Keaton. And she's like, this is where you're going. And it looked great. Looked like camp. There was dating going on. There was a lake. There was milkshakes. I was in. And I only really knew, I should have been paying attention, but I really only knew three states. I knew New York. I knew Pennsylvania, where I went to college, and I knew Florida, because we would go to spring break in Florida. And so I didn't know how to dress for the Midwest in January, because that wasn't in the movie. So I dressed like I always dress during that time of year. I wore like, those Guinea t-shirts, I don't know if you call them that here, they're like white t-shirts and gold chains, and of course I always had five things of hair gel anywhere I went, and I wore like muscle pants, you know, like balloon pants, and I don't know if you guys have seen those, like pajamas. I was always working out, even though I was never at the gym, but I was always looking like I was about to get into the gym. If anybody would say, where are you going? I'm like, I'm going to the gym. Like, weren't we just smoking drugs with you? I'm like, but I'm on the way to the gym. And so I arrived in Minnesota on February 3rd, 1999, in sweatpants, pajamas, and a Guinea t-shirt, and a little windbreaker. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's a cold that can only be imagined. It's like the movie Fargo. It's very serious business. And I knew that I was out of my element. I was not going to be able to finesse this one at negative 40 degrees. And they whisked me off to a treatment center, and then I saw the 12 steps for the first time. And I saw the word alcohol in the first step. Like, the first step has alcohol in it. And I wasn't there for alcohol. I was there for specific for drugs. And I called the concierge over. I'm like, excuse me. Because back then I was hoity-toity. My dad was a big shot in New York. He was in a gambling type of, like a gambling business type of thing. And so I said to the guy, I said, I'm not here for alcohol. I came here for one thing and one thing only. I have a one substance problem. I need to get that substance out of my system. I need to go back to college. I'm in senior year of my college year. And I said, I'm not staying. I picked up my three-piece matching Gucci luggage and I turned around. And I was going to leave that treatment center, and I figured I'd just like raise my voice and I'd make a stink like I usually do back east, and then they would just yield to me. But I obviously wasn't the first New Yorker they met. And plus, they knew I wasn't going anywhere because it was like The Shining. There was like a snowdrift in front of the door. Nobody leaves a treatment center in Minnesota at night. Nobody goes out there. And I tell you that story because it doesn't matter why you're here. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because it was freezing outside. It doesn't matter why you're here. It doesn't matter why you're here. It doesn't matter how you got here. It doesn't matter if your wife ordered, husband ordered, police ordered, the treatment center brought you. You are here. You never have to pick up another drink or drug again for the rest of your life, one day at a time, even if you want to. But we have a new freedom and a new happiness. I mean, this is not only life changing, this is your future changing. This is everything's going to change. And I didn't know that, and I didn't sign up for that. I wanted to get one substance out of me, one substance only. I didn't sign up for Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I was going to Narcotics Anonymous. I think they kind of, you know, rigged me, and they just got me on the van and stick me on Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I don't think this is for me. It was like old people, they're like 50-year-olds. I'm like 21. And you know what they did? The same thing you guys did in here. They loved on me. And I was raw. And I used to curse like, man. And they loved on me. People in the Midwest are nice. People in the South are nice. People where I'm from, not so nice. And they loved on me. And they said, keep coming back, honey. Keep coming. We love you. Keep coming back. Bless your heart. You know all the nice things you guys said. Bless your heart. And I kept coming back. And I got about 18 months and I didn't work the steps. And I was kind of like dual dating between NA and AA. I thought it was like the Match.com type of situation. And I relapsed. And now I relapsed in Minneapolis. Like we were on Bourbon Street today. That North Minneapolis is like Bourbon Street on steroids. Like that type of situation. And it was bad. And my parents had joined a program called Tough Love. It's like Al-Anon, but meaner. Which I didn't even know there could be meaner than Al-Anon, but it's meaner. And so they had learned this whole verbiage and this whole lingo. And I called them, and I'm like, I'm dying out here. It's a freezing. I got no heavy clothes. I'm starving. I'm dying. It's freezing. And they just gave me back the lingo. We didn't cause it. Can't control it. What's the other C?
Can't cure it.
Can't cure it. I'm like, where are my parents? Who are these people? I'm your only son. They're like, we're going to pray for you, son. They left me out there to die. But you know what? Alcoholics Anonymous is always open. And I got myself to a detox. It was a Native American detox. Native American detox, so I had to, you know, definitely tell some stories when I got there. You got to move fast when you're not a Native American, and it only takes Native Americans on a reservation, and it's the middle of it, Minnesota. You don't talk much when you're not a Native American because they ask questions. Like, what tribe you're from? I'm like, can't really speak right now. And they let me stay in a Native American treatment center until I could talk, and then they realized I'm from Long Island tribe, like the Italians. I'm a half Jewish, half Italian. That's that. They didn't want that tribe, and they kicked me out. And I started my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 23 years old, and it was magical. Don't lose the magic. If you're new, don't lose the magic. If you're in the middle of your sobriety, don't lose the magic. If you've been here forever, don't lose the magic. That man that I met on the end, the reason he looks young, at 49 years sobriety, hasn't lost the magic. That's why he's at a conference. Don't lose the magic. You know how you keep the magic? Every day you re-up with God. Every day you get your knees, you get on your knees, you say, God, please keep me sober and show me the man or woman that I'm going to help today, and you re-up the magic. And I had that magic for the first 4 years. I was on fire. I was doing the deal, I was going to meetings, but guess what I didn't do in order and to the fullest and complete and to the best of my ability, I didn't work the steps. So I had 4 years of sobriety and listen, I was 12 years old and I never had a drink and I gave another kid a gun and said shoot at me and it sounded like a great idea. And I had never taken a drink. So 4 years sober, not working the steps, just hanging out with you guys in meetings expecting to me to get better through osmosis, that didn't work either. Osmosis is when you sit in a chair, you don't do any work, and you expect it to come up through your ass. That's osmosis. Ass is in the Bible. I did not curse, so stop that. And I got sicker and sicker and sicker in AA. I was trying to fill this God-sized hole with women and cars and steroids and everything that, and money. And power, and drive my triple black Mustang Cobra to our local AA house, and park it outside in the handicap, and I make sure that everybody's seeing me, and I come in with my big arms and my 5 gold chains, and be like, "Hey, the kid is here." And ego not only returned, but ego got stronger. It was doing push-ups in the parking lot, and as I got my ego, which is edging God out, I moved God out of the place where he should have been, and I put in earthly things that they became idols. And everything started to fall apart real fast. And I was sober 4 years, and everything started to fall apart. And I had money, and I had a nice girlfriend, and everything started to fall apart, started to pull apart the scenes. And then I saw her. I worked in a mall where it had a circus 365 days a year. Fort Lauderdale Swap Shop, it's called. Really, it's a very cool place. And they had a full circus. And my wife, she's going to tell you the story tomorrow, but my wife had come here from the country of Colombia, and nobody picked her up at the airport. And she was all alone in this country. And the people that worked in that circus, they were also in the National Colombian Ballet, and they picked her up. And then they said, listen, if you want a job, you can. The girl that worked on the elephant, she fell off. And you can get a job on the elephant. And my wife went to work the next day there, and they're like, you have any experience with elephants? And my wife did the same thing I did at the Indian reservation. She said, and she started working on elephants. And I saw her. She had a big headdress on, the Las Vegas headdress. She was spinning around on the high wire, whatever that was, the ropes. And she was on riding on the elephant. And I said, I'd never seen something so beautiful. And I said, if I can get that girl's going to fix this inside problem I have. Because I'm 4 years sober, and I'm stark raving crazy. But if I can get her, that's going to fix what's crazy inside me. I don't know if you've ever seen that. You know what people, you know, they're in treatment centers together, and they fall in love on the med line, and they feel like that girl's going to fix her, that guy's going to fix her because they're on the same van. Like, that must be my soulmate. We're on the same van. Oh my God, you have the same tote bag as me? We're meant to be together. They have the same tote bag because you're in the same treatment center. You have the same curfew because you have the same place you're living in. It's not a soulmate, it's a roommate. Anyway, I saw her, and I had to have her, and I pursued her, and she married me, and we had a big AA wedding, and everything was fine. But I brought alcoholism, active alcoholism, without a drink into our marriage. And I could pick any place in the country to go to on my honeymoon, because my wife doesn't know the country. And I picked New Orleans. And she don't know, but I do. And I'm like, honey, it's the home of jazz and Louis Armstrong. It's going to be great. But I didn't know there was a committee meeting below the scenes in my head. The top committee that was listening, that I heard the voices said, why don't you pick New Orleans? It's a place of beauty and it's a place of jazz. But there was a subcommittee meeting that didn't invite me. And they were having a meeting and they said, why don't you go to New Orleans? It's the place of decadence and boobies. And I didn't know they were meeting. And they sent up signals to the committee that I thought we were going to New Orleans because we were going to have a great time in love and all that kind of stuff. And I made reservations at a place called Nola's. It was a brand new restaurant for Emerald Lagasse. It was 25 years ago. I don't know if that's still around. And it was fancy. And in fancy restaurants, they have those little tables right next to each other. And it was a brand new restaurant, and we got in there, and it was our first date in our new marriage. Honeymoon. And we were sitting there, and I was looking at her, and she was looking at me, but I had alcoholism, so I was looking at me too. It was like the three of us at dinner. I'm like staring at myself in the mirror. I'm like, boy, she really got a good deal here. And I'll tell you what, my relapse started in New Orleans. So why don't you tell you how God is so good? That 25 years later to the month, to the time of year, 25 years later, that God brings us back to New Orleans. That's me as the Friday night speaker. And my wife is the Al-Anon speaker. Can we give God a round of applause? Yeah. And as I'm sitting there at Ember Agassi's new restaurant called Nola's, and I got alcoholism all over me, I start feeling like, you know what, I'd like to drink here. I don't know if you've ever been to I know you're from Louisiana, but I don't know if you've been downtown. Everything is about drinking. And it seems very sexy. And the people next to us had something going on that I had never seen in my entire life. They were drinking fine wine that needs to breathe first. I never have seen that. I called over the food server because they had wine. It was in a decanter, and it almost looked like a bomb that had a straw coming out of it. And they weren't drinking. And I couldn't tell my wife because I was 5 years sober, and I didn't want her to know I had alcoholism. So I said to the food server, I said, what are the people doing next to us? She said, they're drinking fine wine that needs to breathe first. I said, my God, there's fine wine that needs to breathe first? I went right from Mad Dog to 2020 to crack. I missed all that. If I had stopped at fine wine that needed to breathe first, I wouldn't need to be in AA. At that moment, I took my powerlessness back. And I felt I was powerful enough to drink fine wine and fine stuff. And I didn't need to be in AA. And I want to tell you something. Here's the truth. If you don't believe you're powerless over alcohol, you are going to drink again. May not be tonight. You don't have to admit to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic, but you have to admit to your innermost self that you're powerless over alcohol. Because at 2 o'clock in the morning, under any given situation, you're in Europe, you're in New Orleans, you're at Nola's restaurant, and if you don't believe you're powerless over alcohol, why would you not drink alcohol? Of course you're going to. And it took 2 years after our honeymoon. 2 years it took for alcohol to come into my mouth. But alcoholism, my full relapse started here on our wedding honeymoon in New Orleans at Nola's. And I knew I was going to drink fine wine. And I picked up my 7-year medallion in my home group, and I went out to look for that night I said, thank you, I'm not coming back to AA, and I went to look for fine wine. But at 27 years old, you got to have a little background in fine wine, and really I just wound up at August Moon Chinese Food Restaurant on Federal Highway in Hollywood, and I ordered Japanese rice wine in a box. And that's as fine as it ever got. That was as high as it ever got. $3.95. I never got fine wine. I never had time to let it breathe. Nothing happened. And the moment I took that drink, something snapped in me. I went like this, my God, you were 7 years sober a minute ago. And now you're out of the program. You were 7 years sober a minute ago. Now you're out of the program. Now you don't know what? You don't need a program. Because you were able to just drink this box of Japanese rice wine and you're fine. And I started to go to AA not sober, because all the people I knew was AA people. These are my friends. You're my family. So I started to go to AA not sober. I would never drink the same night as AA, but I would do drugs the same night, but never drink. I have some respect. And our whole lives fell apart. Mm. We have been brand new married. She married sober Steve, and she got drunk Steve. Now, the crazy thing happened to me during those 7 years. I came in as a drug addict, and somehow, not having a drink for 7 years, I became a real alcoholic. Turns out that where I'm from, half the Walgreens sells liquor. I never saw it. I had never seen all the liquor stores until I started drinking. And my wife said to me, if you ever drink any other day other than a Saturday, you got to go back to AA. And I said, that's a good deal. But if you have alcoholism, you can't make deals like that. You know, all of a sudden I started hiding in places in my house, pretending like I was a woodsmith, like I was making projects. I'm an Italian from Long Island. I don't know anything about making projects. I was making shells all hours of the night. Knock, 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 knock. And I became a real alcoholic. And I couldn't go a day or two without a drink. And our life fell apart. My wife left to Colombia. She had to leave. She thought I was having a nervous breakdown. But she was also having a nervous breakdown. She would wait up night after night after night, looking out the window for her new husband, the husband that she married that was a sober husband, that made a promise, sickness and in health, and all the things I promised. And I couldn't deliver on any of the promises because alcoholism doesn't care if you're married. And I started staying out all hours of the night, doing all different types of substances, which I'm not going to get into here. All the yets happened to me in my home. All the yets happened to me in my hometown. All the people in AA I knew, one time I got lit up at my job. I mean, lit up. I had just done a whole bunch of stuff, and then one of the big members of AA, 34 years at the time, he came to visit me at my store, and I was lit up, and I hid behind the counter. It's not like I have a store with like trees. It's like a booth in a flea market. Not like you can really do a lot of hiding. Like, he was coming in at me, and I went, whoop! Like, he didn't see me. And he stood over me, knowing where I was, and he's like, just tell Steve when he wants to come back. And I was lit up, you know, underneath the counter. My parents had to come out of retirement to come save my business, my wife's and I business, because I had drugged it and drank it all the way. I had robbed our own store. I've done every imaginable thing that you could possibly think of, and I just couldn't get sober. You know, the big book says that if you don't feel like you're an alcoholic, go out and try some controlled drinking. It doesn't say that you probably couldn't possibly die. And I was dying out there. Mm. And let me fast forward the story. I want to get to the good part. Here's the good part. The good part is this: I couldn't get sober. She brought me to a treatment center. I relapsed after the treatment center. She brought me to a detox. I relapsed after the detox. She brought me to another detox. I relapsed after. And every time I went to each one of these places, I had full intent of staying sober. But the moment I got out, I still had reservations. Last time I was at that, I went to a detox, a psych ward, in January 2nd, 2002. And I called up my first sponsor, Jerry Bear. I called him in California. I don't know if you ever met Jerry Bear in California. Part of the Central Pacific, part of the Pacific group, that he's part of the Central Pacific group. And I said, Jerry, what am I going to do? I can't stop drinking. He said, you're going to get down on your knees in the detox, and you're going to ask God to keep you clean and sober while you're in the detox. And he was Jewish, and I'm Catholic, and I figured I was going to like play like a religious thing. I'm like, Jerry, Catholics don't get on their knees outside of Mass. And Jerry said, listen, I don't care what religion you are. If you want to stay clean and sober, you're going to get down on your knees in that detox. Because if I invited you over my house, if you came over my house and you came for Thanksgiving dinner and you grabbed the food and you didn't say please, and then you got up from the table and you left the house and you didn't say thank you, do you think I'd ever invite you back again to my house? And I said, no, Jerry, of course not. He said, so why would you be in God's world one day without saying please for the gift of sobriety in the morning and thanking him for the gift of sobriety at nighttime? He said the disease of alcoholism is not like a flat-footed cop that walks around the streets of New York with a donut in one hand and a cup of coffee in the other. The disease of alcoholism and addiction is like a Secret Service agent that knows how to speak five languages, that walks in and out of parties unnoticed, that knows how to use every weapon in the arsenal. And if you have any respect for your sobriety, you better have that much more respect for the disease of alcoholism. You better start doing the work. And man, it hit me. I'm in a war. I started getting on my knees inside the detox. Dear God, please keep me clean and sober. Please show me the people that I can help in the detox. I thought I was going back to my house, but my wife did this thing called a restraining order, which means you can't go back to your house. I don't know if that's Al-Anon approved, but we'll find out. And I went to a halfway house. I said to the guy when he came to interview me, I said, listen, I own a full house just down the street. I don't need a halfway house. I'm very fully okay. And he held up that piece of paper and go, here's a restraining order. You're about to become homeless. I said, well, tell me about the amenities. And I went to that halfway house and I started praying on my knees every day on my knees. But I got 30 days clean. I don't know if that ever happened to you when you got 30 days, if there's any newcomers in here that relapsed. You got 30 days and I started to start slipping a little bit. I started thinking I could get one more in. I looked at my watch. It was 9 o'clock in the morning. The other people in the halfway house, they went out. I knew they weren't coming back till 5 o'clock. I didn't have a phone, so I couldn't cover my tracks. So I came up with this whole scheme, and I called up my wife, and I said, sweetheart, right there, she knew something's up. Because first of all, there's a restraining order, and second of all, she knew I was lying when my lips were moving. And I said, I need to get a cell phone, and I need to have it immediately, and it's $199. Because I respect people that go out with no money, but I need to have some money in my run. And so I was trying to dope fiend her, alcohol fiend her. And my wife tells me to hold on. And I think she's checking the bank account. Mm. It turns out she had joined Al-Anon. She was in the program of Al-Anon. She had an Al-Anon sponsor. And they get on that Al-Anon phone call. Like the bat phone. And she called up her sponsor and she said, my husband's asking me for $199. And her sponsor says, give him the money. They set me up. I think that's against the rules in Al-Anon also. And they give me the money. I'm newly sober, 30 days, they give me $199 and I run to the Sprint store because I gotta buy the phone, I gotta call my wife, I gotta call the owner of the halfway house, I gotta act like everything's fine, then I gotta go to the house, then I gotta go to the bar, and I gotta drink a certain amount, and then I gotta go home and brush my teeth, and then I gotta shower, and then when everybody comes home, I just gotta act like I'm good. Hey, how was your day? Like I came up with some junkie superpower because I had 30 days and I was going to be able to stop my using in a couple hours. This is how magnificent God is. You want to know what the second step is? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity? That's not something you do in treatment. That's something you do in sobriety. You start living differently in sobriety and something different happens and you realize it couldn't have happened on your own power, and then you realize you came to believe that a power greater than yourself could restore you to sanity because you couldn't have done it on your own. It had to be in him, and all of a sudden something goes off in your brain and goes, wow, I might be really onto something. And I run into the Sprint store and I tell the guy behind the counter, I said, man, I gotta be out of here in 15 minutes. I gotta have the cheapest cell phone you got, and I gotta, you know. And the guy behind the cell phone counter says, hey, Stevie B, we saw you yesterday in the Victory AA meeting. Welcome back. The guy behind the counter in the cell phone store is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that I saw from the day before. Is God good or what?
Yes, he is.
Now, don't get me wrong. I could have pushed through that. Self-will could have came over God's will. I could have pushed through that, but it gave me just enough pause that God's will was able to seep through on what I wanted to do on my own will. And he brought me a cup of coffee, took me outside, and 11 months later, my wife invited me to come back and live in our home. And I was in the big bag again. And she was downstairs, and she was making breakfast. And I was on my knees, and I was thanking God. And I was asking him to keep me clean and sober. And I decided I was going to turn. I came up with this idea that I was going to turn my mattress over because it was lumpy. I hadn't lived there in a year. And when I turned my mattress over, there was my stash. And I had never been able to say no to my stash ever. But God. But God.
Yes.
But God. You see, 11 months later, I'm praying on my knees because I'm really believing that there's a God.
Yep.
I'm asking him to clean me clean and sober, not because my sponsor said it, because it's working. I get off my knees that day different than I did before, and I looked at that, and I had power over that, because I'm not powerless unless I'm without power. And there's one that has all power, and that one is God. And God, the big book says, may you find him now. And I have found him now. And at that moment, I was more powerful with God than the stash that was in my bed. And I called up my wife, and she was crying, and I was crying because I knew I was in it. She was crying because there was stash back in the house, and she had just invited me to live back in the house. It was day one. It was already crazy in the house. But God is a magnificent God.
Yes, he is.
And he's a long-suffering God. And he's patient with a guy like me. He needed to be. I'm a one-eyed crazy Italian with alcoholism. We had some great years in AA. Great years. We started ministries. We started different programs. Al-Anon saved our marriage. I like to make fun of Al-Anon a lot because it's an easy, you know, go-to when you're in an AA meeting. But here's the truth about Al-Anon. It's a magical program.
Yes.
Designed by God himself. So that people not only can deal with us, but deal with their own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I made her a qualifier and brought her into Al-Anon. But Al-Anon put our marriage back together. It's a beautiful program. She started going to Al-Anon, and she started ministering in Al-Anon, and I started ministering in AA, and everything's good, and we want to have a baby. And everything's hitting on all cylinders, and we're sober years, and everything's going just great, and financially we're okay, and we build a baby room in the house, and it's just magical time. And we can't get pregnant. So we go to Columbia, and we get eggs donated, and we can't get pregnant. And then we get pregnant. We hired a surrogate. I don't know if you know that. That's their job. That's what they do. That should be like a slam dunk. That didn't work. Nothing's working. Well, we get pregnant. And when we go to the doctor, we find out that that my wife loves the baby. And I didn't see that coming. Because I'm believing that I'm not going to be going through any tough times because I'm sober, I'm in AA, I'm taking meetings, I'm sponsoring people, I'm in church, I'm doing everything the big book says, I pray every day, I'm a good person, and I didn't see it coming. And some well-meaning people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and they're well-meaning. They didn't mean to hurt me. They said something like we hear in AA, they say, well, God only gives you what you can handle. That's not true. That's a terrible thing to say to someone that lost a husband or a wife or a baby or a child, or someone was murdered. You don't tell them God only gives you what you can handle. This is what you tell them. Life's going to give you some stuff, Steve. Mm. But God will help you get through it.
That's right.
And that's what happened. We had a baby room built, and we were broken. Every day we'd go by there, and we would cry. Every day I said, God, I can't believe this has happened to me. I'm 10 years sober. My wife's 10 years sober. My wife's like 25 years sober. I can't believe this is happening. But God had a plan. And he always does. And I want you to know if you're in here tonight, he has a plan. And if they tell you you're not going to have your nursing license back because you used it to pop pills when you were a nurse and took half the medication and didn't give the other half to the patients, and you get sober and you go with God, you're going to get your nursing license back. I tell you that day you're not going to get your driver's license because you're drunk and you've been 3 DUIs, and you stay sober and you serve God, and watch, you get your license back. Some of the people that work in, I own a treatment center. Some of the people that work for me are the worst criminals in the world, not anymore. And I was that same person. God makes a way where there's no way. Alcoholics Anonymous makes a way where there's no way. And while we were in adoption agency, we're trying to adopt a baby, which is a beautiful blessing. We got asked to leave the adoption agency, which is a big deal. Because now we can't have a baby, and now we can't adopt a baby. It turns out that I did some things in Alcoholics Anonymous in my first sobriety, because I was such a wonderful person, that make it so that we couldn't adopt a baby. And you don't have to, you know, use that much imagination. I tried to pick up a woman coming out of a meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous. It turns out she was a police officer. I don't know if you know what I'm saying. And so I can't adopt a baby. So what are we going to do? Well, God had a plan. And there was a member of our home group named Happy Bob. And Happy Bob was a very important attorney before he got caught with 3 kilos, but he still had connections. And Happy Bob, may God rest his soul, he just went home to be with the Lord, incredible guy. He had introduced us to a woman in AA. He had introduced us to a woman through some connections by the name of Mindy, and she's from Boca. And I know that doesn't mean anything to you if you're not from Boca, but Boca is like where a lot of Jewish people live. And by this time, my wife and I are like over the top Christians. We're like, we got a giant Jesus on the wall. We got St. Francis statues. We got holy water. We got stickers. We got t-shirts. We're like over the top. And I say to my wife, I said, sweetheart, Mindy's coming to do the home study. We probably should take giant Jesus off the wall. Let's be like, you know, like in the middle type Christian, you know, like not like. And I said, giant Jesus should probably go in the closet. And when we get the home study done, we take giant Jesus out and we put him back on the wall. And my wife, she's so wise. She said, we're not going to pretend who we're not. We're not going to ask God to bless us and pretend who we're not. She said, if God's going to bless us, God's going to bless us. Not because we're faking it. And God blessed us. She looks up at giant Jesus. She said, do you think God gave you another chance? Because my resume is terrible. Felon charges, drive. It's terrible. On paper, I look terrible. But not to God. And she says, I'm going to give you another chance. You think God gave you another chance? I said, no, he did. She said, I'm going to give you another chance. And she signs off on the home study. And we fly up. Now, here's the most amazing thing. You can get past home study and wait 12 years for a baby. Like within a couple months, we get a call from up in the top of the United States by California. To a state we've never been to, and we land in a state we've never been to with a horse in the middle of the airport. And we meet our son's mom, birth mom. He was just born that morning. And she's holding up this little beautiful baby, and she says, what would you like to name this baby? And we say, we'd like to name him Joshua. And she says, why Joshua? We say, because in the Bible, Joshua 24:15 says, for me and my house, We choose to serve the Lord.
That's right.
And she said, well, I'm not religious. I said, well, all that means is that your son, our son, is going to grow up in a godly home where there's not going to be any drinking, probably not much cursing, a lot of love. Because sometimes cursing has slipped in the last 13 years. Like, I don't curse, but when I'm building something and I hit my finger with a hammer, I don't say praise the Lord, you know what I'm saying? You know how God showed up in our life? Not only did we take that little baby home, there was members of Alcoholics Anonymous on our lawn with signs, welcome home Joshua. They took care of our dogs when we were away, welcome home Stephen and Sandra. And that baby grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I put him in a little pouch, a little kangaroo pouch, went everywhere. That baby's been to thousands of meetings. That baby's been on retreats and Jesus walks and everything you could possibly imagine. But this is how God showed up. He was bald and white. We went to a part of the country where they make really white babies. I mean, he's really white. And my wife and I, we're not that white. So he doesn't look anything like us. We go and pick him up at the daycare. We have to give him triple form of identification every time. But listen to what God did just to show us how much he was concerned about the little things and wanted to just remind us that he's thinking about us all the time. When our baby was 13 months old, he came out with the most beautiful red hair and the most beautiful green eyes and the most beautiful freckles on his little tiny nose, and he looks exactly. During this time, a lot of times I have a picture up that comes up on the screen of my mom and my son, and he looks exactly like my mom.
Yes.
I mean, how does God do that? God does that because he wants you to know that this is a cherry on the Sunday. He wants you to know that he's concerned with the little things. He's got plans to prosper us, not to harm us.
Yes.
He's got so many plans for us. Listen, you want to be a doctor? Then listen, go to school, do the stuff. You don't have the money, money's going to come. There's all different things that are going to happen to you one day at a time. You're going to have your life beyond your wildest dreams. Don't just sign up for sober. If you came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you're shooting for sober. That's a low shot. You get a relationship with God, you're going to get sober. You're going to stay sober, but you're also going to have a life around the wild streets. I'm not saying it's going to be easy. I'm not saying this is going to be easy. I'm sure if I asked Bill if it was easy, he's going to tell me it hasn't been easy. But it's going to be the best thing that's ever happened to you.
That's right.
I want to tell you, I'm going to finish with this. I haven't gotten all the different signs from my friend in the back. He was supposed to flash some things. I don't know what that whole thing was. I got one eye. He's talking to me about flashing lights at me. And then he expects me to try to remember it. He's like, this green light means this amount of time. And then I'm going to give you a red light and that's amount of time. I'm like, I got one eye. I don't even know what you're talking about. You stop flashing lights at me from back there. I don't know what you're doing. There's people in Alcoholics Anonymous that sign up for sober. It's like going to a buffet. It's like going to a buffet where all the most amazing foods in the world are being served. And you go up to the salad section and you grab a crouton. And you go back in your seat and you get your fork and your knife and you're eating your crouton. People come up to you, years sober people, how you doing? Hanging in there. Did you know this prime rib on the buffet? No, I'm good. I'm going to just stick with the crouton. I've been eating this crouton for 35 years. Yeah, but did you know there's like beignets on the other end? No. This has worked just fine for me. And those are the just sober people. And then there's the people that sign up for a life beyond the world. Fourth dimension of existence. They have a personal relationship with the creator of the universe. They know that no matter what happens, as long as they stay sober, serve God, clean house, trust God, clean house, help others, work the steps, pass this on, do conventions, do everything that's involved, they're going to have an amazing life. You're never going to go hungry. You're never going to be homeless. You're never going to have any of that stuff happen. Hold on before you go. What is he talking about? He doesn't know. Could members of Alcoholics Anonymous bite you over your home On Sunday, I'm going over to beautiful Brandy's and her husband's house. We're going to have brisket. I don't know what that's all about. It must be a big thing. Where she's like, we got 20-pound brisket. I'm like, okay. I don't know what that even means, but it seems very important. I'm smoking it, okay? You invited me over your house, I'm coming. I don't even know what you mean, smoking a brisket. You're not going to have the problems that you would have if you're drinking and about being alone, because we're never alone. When the people die in your family, you're going to have people from Alcoholics Anonymous that are going to show up that you didn't even know knew you. When things happen in your family that you go to a hospital or people in the hospital, there's going to be people from Alcoholics Anonymous that you didn't think liked you show up in a hospital room to say, hey, we're here for you. Something happens to your car, they say, hey, can I pick you up? If you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not if you're standing on the outside and you stop in every 6 months, but if you're a member, members take care of members. This is what Dr. Bob said, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know. Like that. First of all, they asked Dr. Bob, how do you feel about people that don't go to meetings, Dr. Bob? He said, I have no use for them because they have no gratitude. This is Founders Week, June 10, 1935. Founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, we call that the Founders Day. Dr. Bob, Bill W., the Lord, and all the people that got this thing together in the beginning, the co-founder said, I don't have any use for people that don't go to meetings. They have no gratitude. He said, well, Dr. Bob, how do you feel? Why do you keep going back to meetings? This is what he said. I spend a great deal of time passing on what I've learned to others who want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. One, a sense of duty. This is in his story in the big book, Dr. Bob's Nightmare. Number two, it's a pleasure. This is a pleasure. Going to great meetings is a pleasure. You don't like your home group, get another one. Start another. There's great meetings. If you're not in one, make one. I ain't going in complaining. My meeting stinks. Go make a great one. I go to great meetings. Matter of fact, I don't even know bad meetings. When I get there, it's a great meeting. I went to a meeting in Long Island, New York. They don't start off with a serenity prayer. I said, excuse me, I know I'm visiting, but what is the AA is prayer to prayer. I said, no, I'm just going to pray right now. It's my turn to check. God, grant me this. Change the meeting. Number three, because in doing so, I'm paying a debt to the man or woman who took time to pass it on to me. And number four, because every time I do it, I take a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. Last night, we were in New Orleans, the city of New Orleans. I hadn't been there in 25 years. And I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. But this is the first time I've been in New Orleans for 25 years. And drinking, I'm not saying I've thought about drinking, but for some reason, they try to make it very sexy there. Everything is drinking. We were in a hotel with drinking, and then they had a room that you pushed a wall, and it was a speakeasy that was drinking, and everything in our room was drinking. They have bourbon bottles and all these things that look like fine stuff, and it's drinking on top of drinking. I had put the time in the last 22 years. It had no power over me. It was a thought. I said, that's a good looking bottle. I bet you it'd be good to drink it at. And then in a moment, instantaneously, sanity returned. I said, well, you're an alcoholic, Steve. You can't be drinking. I said, you're right. I'm an alcoholic. Ed, I'm the speaker tomorrow night at the Ed Convention. That'd be a terrible testimony. I got to give you one more story. I know you're going to do those lights. I got to give you one more story. It was my 50th birthday, and we all went on a cruise down to Cozumel, Mexico. And I was there. It was the most perfect day I've ever had. It was amazing. I was there with Steve and Patty and my mom and my dad, may God rest his soul, and my baby. He was like 6 years old, and I was 50. I was 7 years ago. It was a perfect day out there, perfect climate. I don't know if you've ever been in a pool where they have the chairs in the pool. I love that. And I was in a chair in the pool. And one of my friends from Alcoholics Anonymous, he came by and he handed me a $100 cigar. He said, I got this, very rare. I said, wow. I was smoking a $100 cigar. in the pool. All my friends, my family, best day of my life. And a song came on called Despacito. I love that song. And I love to dance. My wife's Colombian, we dance. And I was in the pool, I'm going, Despacito. My guard was down. At that moment, a little Mexican guy, because we were in Mexico, he goes, mojitos.
Drinks.
Mojitos. I'd never heard of a mojito. But at that moment, it sounded very appealing. Turns out it's an alcohol drink, and they smoosh it around with mint and all this different stuff and sugar. Alcohol and sugar is like the two best worlds. And I thought to myself, man, this would be perfect. With this cigar, a mojito in Mexico, I'm 50 years old, this is going to be a perfect end to this day. And a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a circuit speaker, he looks over at me and he goes, hey, Steve. And I go, yeah. He doesn't know what's going on in this crazy alcoholic head. I recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, but at that moment, mental illness had returned. I didn't even know it was in there because it sounded like my voice. My friend, because God told him to call me, he goes, hey, Steve. I go, what? What, Scott? He goes, you know the only thing that could ruin this day? I go, what, Scott? He goes, alcohol. I go, that's right, Scott. Sanity had returned.
Amen.
So Dr. Bob finishes off and says, if you really and truly want to quit drinking liquor for good and all, and sincerely feel that you must have some help, we know that we have the answer for you. It never fails. As long as you put in one half the zeal that you put into drinking, you put into the program, it never fails.
Right.
And then he finishes with the promise. And this is the promise that I have found to come true. And I believe that we're going to hear this from all the speakers this weekend. He reminds us that our Heavenly Father will never let us down. God bless you guys.
That's
Thanks
right.
so much.